from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Student safety is our top priority in considering whether we would institute class suspension. When considering the class suspension arrangements in Central and Western districts, we have to see where the students who may come from different districts will be affected. So having regard to the traffic conditions, we consider it more appropriate to have all schools in the districts to have class suspended. Again, this will create less confusion to parents and schools concerned.
That was Hong Kong's Assistant Secretary of Education, Sophia Wong, on Friday, announcing the closing of schools in the face of street protests there. Some government buildings were also closed. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
Demonstrations continue in Hong Kong. The chief executive, Leung Chun-ying, is again calling on demonstrators to stop their protest. He says Hong Kong must stick to the policy of one country and two systems. For more analysis, we welcome back Victor Gao. He's a Chinese international relations analyst. Victor, one of the things that doesn't seem to be getting a lot of traction, I should say, in the reporting here in the West, is about the changeover in 1997. Martin Jacques writes in The Guardian that Hong Kong was a British colony, forcibly taken from China, and all of its 28 subsequent governors were appointed by the British government. Under British rule, it never enjoyed democracy. You were the interpreter for Deng Xiaoping, and what are your recollections, going back to that time, and what are your thoughts about today?
Well, first of all, I think Deng Xiaoping proposed the genius concept of one country, two system, which actually broke the deadlock in the Chinese UK negotiations about the return of Hong Kong in 1997. And I think the concept of one country, two system will continue to guide Hong Kong forward in the coming years and decades. It will make sure that Hong Kong will keep its capitalist system, which is different from what mainland China has. Now, coming back to the point we are talking about in Hong Kong, I think Hong Kong is a democracy. People there have the legal right to demonstrate and protest. However, when the protesters do exercise their democratic rights, they need to do so by abiding by the law and listening to the all instructions by the police. Now, in the Occupy Central movement that we are witnessing right now, there are cases where the protesters actually disobey the orders from the police, and they are actually violating the rights of other people in Hong Kong who want to go to school, who want to go to work, etc. So I think today they are issuing ultimatum about, you know, having the chief executive to resign, or about China changing its position on the nominating committee, for example. I think issuing such ultimatum is not helpful. And also, I think it's time to urge and appeal to the protesters that when you exercise your rights of protest and demonstrate, you need to abide by the law. And the rule of law should be respected by everyone in Hong Kong, because without rule of law, you are not going to get democracy anyway. And it is a much more constructive way to express your political opinion or position if you do so by abiding by the law rather than violating the rule of law in Hong Kong. That's the key message that the protesters in the streets in Hong Kong need to listen. And I think this not only applies to Hong Kong, it applies to every country in the world. Say that in the United States, in UK, for example, in France, etc. So restraint need to be applied to both sides, the law enforcement agency in Hong Kong, but also the protesters in the street. They need to do so by abiding by the law rather than violating the law.
What do you think the next steps are in all of this?
I think right now there is a standoff. Fortunately, today is still a holiday in Hong Kong. And so the collateral damage to the economic and financial activities in Hong Kong still could be controllable. But once Hong Kong resumes the working schedule, then the current standstill, which may further escalate according to the demands raised by the protesters, will become more and more of a toll on the economic and political and the financial situation in Hong Kong. For example, I was in Hong Kong on September the 29th and 30th, and I saw with my own eyes that while the protesters themselves were more or less peaceful, but the consequences that they created by occupying streets, occupying major traffic routes, etc., was horrendous for Hong Kong. Schools had to be closed. Kids can no longer go to school in Hong Kong. And then the financial market is coming down. Property price probably will come down very soon. And people cannot get around in the areas occupied by the protesters. And also, I think garbage bags are piling up by the roadside because the garbage trucks can no longer move back and forth to collect them. So I would say the collateral damage by the illegal occupation and demonstrations are such that Hong Kong, as a very small and compact place, cannot afford to sustain for the long term. It is time for the protesters to resort to better means. For example, if they really want to protest, they can apply for approval and do the demonstration in Victoria Park, which is big enough to accommodate all the protesters in Hong Kong.
Hong Kong's chief executive said that he has no intention of resigning, as the protesters have demanded. One of the two main student groups behind the demonstrations issued a statement Thursday agreeing to meet with the deputy chief secretary, Carrie Lam, but called for the talks to be held in public, adding that the protesters' occupation of key parts of Hong Kong would continue and that the outcome of the talks would determine whether they adopted even more aggressive tactics. According to the New York Times late Friday, Secretary Lam met in the evening with four lawmakers who support the protesters, and no progress was reported. Some worried that further escalation by protesters could alienate members of the public resentful of the inconveniences affecting their daily lives. There were reports late Friday that crowds of pro-government protesters had moved against the anti-government occupiers. Also, Hong Kong police issued warnings to protesters that if they didn't disperse from some locations, they could face the Chinese equivalent of the pepper spray that is a common component of American protests.
The primary use of tear smoke is to disperse crowds instead of causing any injury to people. The tear smoke used by the force is a kind of irritant and harassing substance. A person being affected by tear smoke will only feel a temporary hot sensation and also experience tear streaming. The recovery time is relatively short, as the effect usually lasts for only a few minutes without causing any permanent effect on health. The use of a tear smoke by the force meets international standards. Some organizers have threatened to escalate the actions by surrounding government buildings. This would not only cause disruption to the daily lives of citizens, but also intensify the conflicts between the general public and the protester, which may cause serious risks to public order. We stress that police will not tolerate any illegal surrounding of government buildings. Police urge the protester to remain calm and restrained. Do not block and charge any government buildings, including those of law enforcement departments.
Martin Jacques is a British journalist and academic, and the author of a book entitled When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. He offers a view of the events in Hong Kong through the lens of its history as a British colony.
For 155 years, the British ruled Hong Kong, and they never, ever introduced universal suffrage. So Hong Kong under the British was never a democracy. And I think it's very important to recognize it was the Chinese government that gave Hong Kong the opportunity of electing their chief executive by universal suffrage. The other point to say is one country, two systems also granted Hong Kong a level of autonomy which they had never experienced before under British rule. So a whole set of new opportunities were opened up by the handover.
Repression of dissent in Bahrain, the home of the U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf, where the government has been conducting a crackdown on opposition, which includes thousands of arrests, was the subject of sharp criticism by the U.N. Secretary General's office. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
The detention of human rights campaigners in Bahrain sends a chilling message to other activists, according to the United Nations. Nabil Rajab was arrested on Wednesday on his return to Bahrain following a trip overseas where he discussed the human rights situation in his country with a number of organizations, including the UN. It's the second such incident in less than a month in the Gulf country. Stefan Dujarric is the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
The detention of a high-profile human rights activist like Rajab and Mariam Al-Khawaja, who was arrested last month, sends a chilling message to other activists of the consequences they may face for any criticism of authorities. Human rights defenders in Bahrain must be able to carry out their work without fear of reprisal.
Mr. Rajab was initially charged with publicly insulting a government institution on social media and has been detained for a week pending investigation. The United Nations Human Rights Office has called on the Bahraini authorities to release him immediately. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
No descansaremos en la lucha contra las fuerzas del mal.
We will not tire in fighting the forces of evil, terrorism, paramilitaries, organized crime, and all types of violence.
That was the Minister of Interior, Justice and Peace for Venezuela, Miguel Rodriguez Torres, as his office released details surrounding the murder of a member of his country's National Assembly, Robert Serra, from the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, or PSUV. The party of President Nicolas Maduro and the late Hugo Chavez.
No habrá impunidad. Sabemos.
There will be no impunity. We know that crimes like these will be rejected by everyone.
Y estamos seguros que los sectores conscientes de ella.
And anyone who is conscientious will know to respect this sad time and will not participate in any disrespectful acts at this moment of Venezuelan spirituality.
Exhortamos a los venezolanos.
We ask Venezuelans, especially those political sectors opposed to the government, not to convert this tragic occurrence into a media spectacle without fully considering the pain felt by his family, friends, colleagues, and everyone who is working tirelessly every day to construct a safe and peaceful country.
The justice minister said Sierra was, quote, an important leader in the PSUV and was visibly committed to the revolutionary process and to the commander Hugo Chavez, closed quote. He called his murder a planned assassination, organized to the finest detail. He said the preliminary investigation indicated that the murder was done over a time of 15 to 20 minutes with a high-powered weapon. The assassination of one of the rising stars of Venezuela's next generation of socialist leaders came on the heels of an alleged assassination plot against an existing leftist head of state in Latin America, Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. Press TV's Manuel Gifani filed this report from Buenos Aires.
President Cristina Kirchner addressed the nation with a heartfelt speech from the presidential palace, where she delivered a new harsh message against the U.S., which she accused of attacking Argentina, both at the political and the financial front. She affirmed recent U.S. justice rulings are aimed at bringing down her government and threatening Argentina's sovereignty. Her statements create another crack in the already frayed relationship with the Obama administration.
The president is known for being very straightforward about what's going on. Basically, she described the global action of the Walter Funds, which are clearly supported by the ruling of a U.S. judge, by the statements of U.S. officials. That's not a coincidence.
While the so-called Vulture Funds carry a $1 million lobby campaign at the Congress in Washington, a number of U.S. companies based in Argentina have suspiciously filed bankruptcy, though their balances appear to be quite profitable. Opposition leaders affirm the government's conspiracy theory is nonsense, but specialists disagree.
Of course, the president's speeches sometimes narrow everything down to the struggle against savage financial capitals and imperialism, but in fact the statistics show that she is able to gather more and more social support about the issue, especially among those who are no longer approving her administration.
President Kirchner, who as reported by the local press was threatened to death by terrorist organizations linked with ISIL, affirmed her enemies are not to be found in the Middle East.
If something happens to me and I am not joking, please look to the north, not to the east. After witnessing the things I did, both here and at the United Nations, especially the huge amount of cynicism, I wouldn't be surprised if ISIL plot, disclosed by the local media, is another U.S. fiction aimed at covering up other crimes.
The tension between Washington and Buenos Aires has been simmering since the U.S. interim ambassador made very critical comments on the government's policies, which was considered as a meddling into the country's internal affairs. Opposition members, however, claim the government is taking advantage of the conflict in order to divert the attention from the deep economic crisis and rising poverty. Manuel Gifoni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
Argentina is in the second year of its two-year term on the UN Security Council. This month, it holds the presidency of the council. Argentina's permanent representative to the UN, Maria Cristina Perceval, will be chairing the council for October. She held an hour-long press conference Thursday where she laid out her agenda for the month. When she called the last question from the press, she was asked about the threat against the life of her country's president.
President Kirchner said yesterday that if something happens to her, they should look not to the Middle East, but to the North. As someone who's been in New York for a while, are you aware of any plan to hurt your president?
I wouldn't laugh if a head of state talks about attempts to destabilize a sovereign state.
We'll have more on that death threat against Argentina's president, and we'll hear from our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, later in this newscast. There were a number of items that Ambassador Perceval promised to place on this month's agenda at the Security Council, which the U.S. may not want brought to the floor. Among these is the issue of the legality of the U.S. military operation in Syria against the so-called ISIS group, which was not placed on the agenda during September when the council was chaired by the U.S.
My question has to do with Syria, whether you think in this month the airstrikes taken by the United States and five Arab countries on Syria without their consent, just notifying them, will come to some sort of a vote or discussion in the council. Even the Pope has said he believes that this should be done through the council. And I wondered, do you think it can be? Do you think it will be? What is Argentina's position on it?
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. You know that we have the briefing on chemical weapons this month, as well as the humanitarian situation in Syria. And we can't say that there will be no interest on the political situation, but it's not something which has been included in the program as of yet. Obviously, we have an interest in knowing about the situation. Just give me a little bit of time on this.
The U.S. claim to legitimacy for the strikes is not recognized by everyone. RT spoke with Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition about the latest terror boogeyman, the so-called Khorasan group.
Essentially, this was a concoction by the Pentagon and especially the administration because they needed a legal rationale for carrying out what amounts to an unlawful policy. The open-ended bombing of Iraq and Syria against the Islamic State can't happen without congressional authorization. Only Congress can declare war. It can't happen without the UN Security Council. That didn't happen. So what the Obama administration needed, again, let's remember that they said the Islamic State poses no imminent danger to the American people. What they needed was a danger that did pose an imminent danger to the American people, because then under the condition of imminent danger, the president can say he has the emergency power to carry out the war. So the Khorasan grouping became a very convenient but essentially necessary part of the propaganda justifying an illegal war with the premise of legality, again, by an imminent threat against a group no one had ever heard of.
At yesterday's press conference, the Argentine ambassador noted that a proposed resolution on Palestine was also not on the agenda from last month.
Have the Palestinians or anybody in the Arab group come to you to schedule a date for discussing the proposed resolution?
No. No contacts have been made by the Arab group or by any specific ambassador, not until now.
One question from the press gave the ambassador pause and caused her to reply very cautiously to the extent that she would only answer in a personal and not official capacity as either council president or Argentine ambassador. The disparate treatment of war crimes in Africa and elsewhere, amid reports of mass graves, allegedly extrajudicial killings by the Ukrainian government forces in Donetsk in the eastern Ukraine.
Regarding the ICC, there have been accusations that primarily African countries are brought before the ICC. But it appears that war crimes have been committed. Mass graves have been discovered near Donetsk. The Wall Street Journal and one of our colleagues, Joe Loria, pointed out there's evidence that the snipers that were killing civilians in Kiev came from the Maidan, and the investigation into that has never, ever been either followed through or answered. The questions have been raised for months. What are the criteria by which you decide which countries or which individuals or groups are brought before the ICC? Because if you have war crimes committed in a European country, and in this case it looks fairly, incriminating, why are these ignored and permitted?
Muchas gracias por su bienvenida.
Thank you for your warm welcome. I'm going to answer in my personal capacity. I'm going to answer your interesting question with another question in my personal capacity, of course. Without any doubt, the fight against impunity through the justice system is turning out to be a long process. But it doesn't make any sense to undo what already has been done. And this is precisely because it is clear, it is tangible, that we need international criminal justice. We need international criminal justice so that impunity does not become common currency amongst us, accompanied by cynicism.
Ambassador Percival said that during her term as president, the Security Council will also look at various reform proposals for the UN structures this month, including expanding the number of permanent members of the Council, as well as reform of the veto power. She said that although these proposals have been repeatedly made over the years, no one has yet bothered to even chart their history, let alone develop a reform plan to pass along to the General Assembly.
It is in the General Assembly where the reform of the Security Council is being debated and must be debated. When we began here as chair of this working group, we didn't start from scratch. But rather, we looked at the issues that had been worked on, and we discovered, for example, that there was no institutional memory of the group, but there were simply reports. We were saying, it was said, etc. So one of the first things that we adopted was the handover. In other words, whoever comes in to take over needs to know where the light switch is. That's how we get institutionality. We create it and we get more stability as well.
It appears that it's going to be a very busy month at the UN Security Council, and we'll keep you apprised of further developments there. And now, a report from our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo in Managua.
Listening in amazement, more or less, to the speech or the press conference yesterday by the permanent representative of Argentina to the United Nations, Maria Cristina Percival, and who is also from the same political party as the president of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez. There's been apparently a threat against her life, allegedly from ISIS, and she said, if anything happens to me, don't look to the east, look to the north, saying that if I get killed, the United States did it, in essence. She couldn't have been clearer. And at the press conference yesterday, the very last question to Ambassador Percival, who is sitting in as president of the UN Security Council this month and was discussing the agenda that she's going to lay out there, what's coming to the table, which is under her control, they asked her, you know, well, gee, what do you think about you? You're here in New York. What do you think about your president? Is she really in any danger? And the person laughed. And she had quite a strong response to that.
Right. What you're referring to in those the allegations of death threats against the Argentinian president have to be seen in the context, and I think self-evidently have to be seen in the context of increasing aggression by the US-backed Latin American right-wing opposition in different countries.
Yeah.
And in Argentina, it's taking the form of all kinds of economic destabilization. Perhaps we could look at that a little bit later. But the other day, was it the day before yesterday, there was this horrific murder in Caracas of one of the up-and-coming young politicians in Nicolas Maduro's political party, the PSUV in Venezuela. Roberto Serra and his wife were murdered. And Roberto Serra was 27.
Right.
And I don't have any details about his wife, but he was regarded as an extremely promising young politician.
Right.
And I think he was actually the youngest deputy in Venezuela's National Assembly.
Yep.
And he'd been very outspoken in recent weeks about the way elements from Colombia that he alleged were under the control of former President Álvaro Uribe Vélez, the former Colombian president who's closely associated with narco trafficking and paramilitary activity in Colombia, and the Venezuelan authorities have for a long time been arguing that the various activities of destabilization, various terrorist attacks, are ultimately being backed by Álvaro Uribe and his circle from Colombia, and that's, you know, I don't know what would happen in Washington, for example, if a young senator and his wife were murdered in their house by people from overseas opposition. It would probably call for a cruise missile attack somewhere.
Oh, for sure. Rand Paul buys it with his wife in some little suburb in Virginia, and the cruise missiles are definitely flying.
Right, so, you know, and that's how serious it is in terms of Venezuela's national politics. And in terms of the region, it reinforces people's feeling that the right-wing opposition in Latin America, backed by the United States, are becoming more and more desperate as progressive governments continue to get re-elected and continue to implement programs that are promoting regional integration, regional autonomy, against what the United States government perceives as its own interests and against what local right-wing oligarchies on the more extreme sections of those oligarchies regard also as inimical to their interests. So, you know, what the remarks by leaders like Christina Kirchner about the U.S. being behind attempts to destabilize her government are pretty much statements of the obvious for anybody who's
That's right.
been following events in Latin America over the last, 60 years?
100 years.
100 years. You know, and it's just, it's so obvious, isn't
Remember
it?
The Maine. Remember the Maine, 1898. Okay.
Right, okay.
That's 116 years.
Right, okay. So, or even before, because in Nicaragua, people remember William Walker and the attempts to integrate Nicaragua and the Central American region into the slave-owning South.
That's right, absolutely.
So, you know, know, that history is long, bitter, and very, very much remembered in particular by nationalist and progressive politicians here in the region.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.